Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm just a caveman.
Due to habeas corpus, you and Miss Bonifante had a common law marriage.
So you don't work on a contingency basis?
No. Money down. Oops, shouldn't have this bar association logo here either.
Would you please point at that robot over there? No further questions.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 56. I'm your host, Thomas Smith, and that over there is your host, Andrew Torres. How are you doing today, Andrew?
Fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
Doing great. We are going to answer a very interesting question, Andrew. So let's go to, let's break down some law, shall we?
Absolutely.
Down.
The law.
Down.
The law.
Down.
The law.
Down.
The law.
So, weird thing happened. Again, we record this a little ahead of time, but this, I think it's Nunez. This guy, you may have seen last week, he just gave a press conference, like a part, he's part of the House Intelligence Committee.
And yeah, he's the chairman.
Actually. Oh, he's the chairman. That's right. Yeah. And he just gave a briefing to the press without any other member of the committee knowing about it. Like, he just did it and divulged stuff that ranking Democrat Adam Schiff said, who's a ranking Democrat on the committee, said he didn't even know about the stuff Devin Nunez was talking about. So there's some interesting stuff happening there. People have asked, did he just, with all the Republicans have been making a big deal with how much they've been talking about leaks, and that's been the focus of their, anytime Comey's testifying, anytime anyone else is testifying before Congress, the Republicans are just interested in these leaks. They don't care about any of the illegal stuff actually going on. They just want to know who's tattling. So with all that said, didn't Chairman Devin Nunez just leak stuff himself? Didn't he just leak classified material to the White House because he did this little briefing? So did he violate 18 USC 793F, Andrew?
Yep. Yeah. So a couple things here. And by the way, the answer to that question is yes. If you like, you just want the answer and want to turn off the show, yes. So a few things. Nunez believed that as part of his intelligence briefing, or appears to have believed as part of his intelligence briefing, that he had some kind of evidence of, you know, that supported the Trump conspiracy theory that he was being wiretapped by President Obama. That has been conclusively disproven, that the information relates to conversations between Trump and individuals who were targets of FISA court warrants, legitimate FISA court warrants. And Nunez himself has said that those were validly procured surveillance warrants, right? So there is nothing that supports the wild Trump allegations. If you're seeing that, that's not true. There's nothing that supports any illegal activity. And I mean, in fact, like, the most troubling aspect of it is that Donald Trump is talking to people who are themselves the subject of FISA court warrants. But what I found profoundly interesting about this question is our listeners who have been with us for several months might recognize statute 18 USC 793F because it is the same statute that we discussed at great length in Opening Arguments episode 16 about Hillary Clinton's emails. And in fact, the statute provides as follows. It says, whoever being entrusted with or having lawful possession or control of any document, related to the national defense, one, through gross negligence, permits the same to be removed from its proper place of custody or delivered to anyone in violation of his trust, or to be lost, stolen, abstracted, or destroyed, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years or both. And so we evaluated that statute as to whether Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server violated 18 U.S.C. 793 F1 that I just read. And we concluded, in light of the long history of prosecutions, read through over 240 cases that were 18 U.S.C. 793 cases, that that subsection, even though it uses the words gross negligence, that no case has ever been brought, let alone a conviction has been secured to anybody who failed to have the willful intent to disclose or destroy confidential information. So we talked about cases like the guy who discovered that he had confidential information in his gym bag and then shoved it into a desk drawer and forgot about it, right? Yeah. Or the guy who was supposed to destroy documents, but instead threw them in a dumpster for neighborhood kids to find, you know, things like that. And what we found lacking for Hillary Clinton as a result of the FBI's own internal investigation was that critical element of intent. And the intent was not only read into the statute by practice, but there was also a strong suggestion that in the absence of intent, that the statute would be unconstitutionally vague, right? That you would wind up criminalizing accidental behavior and that that would not survive constitutional scrutiny. So that was our Hillary Clinton analysis. Now let's apply that same analysis to House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes, who received information clearly labeled confidential as part of his briefing. This was not like, oh, what does the C mean at the bottom? Like, are you really? This wasn't
mislabeled emails header, or whatever. Yeah.
Said the guy saying this is now congressman, this is confidential information. And he ran out and held a press conference about it. It is. That is at the core of what the statute prohibits, right? It prohibits the disclosure causes to be communicated, delivered, or transmitted.
Yeah, it seems pretty intentful.
Right.
Intentional, I guess.
Yeah. And so we're sort of keeping a running tally of people who violated the law who appear to never
They're never held accountable.
It appears that they're never going to be held accountable for it. This is a very, very clear case. And I would love for anybody, I would particularly love for anybody to make the case that Hillary Clinton should be busting rocks in Leavenworth, but Devin Nunes should not, right? Like that's impossible. That I feel very confident to say that case is impossible to make, no matter how tortured a definition of the law you have. And it really is. The legal answer is sufficient. This clearly violates the law. It clearly violates the Espionage Act. The only argument that you could make is that the information is not sufficiently vital to the national defense. That would require an analysis of the entire briefing versus the amount that was disclosed. But that's typically not a good argument.
Did anyone ever make that argument with Hillary? Because I don't remember.
No, of course not. Of course you didn't make that argument with Hillary because I didn't even try in our OA-16 because this is not typically a successful argument.
Okay.
You know, if a document is clearly labeled confidential, it is, you know, there is a presumption that attaches to it that it has been so classified because it is vital to the national defense. And courts, and you can understand this, right? Like, let's leave aside, you know, Democrat, Republican. I don't want courts second guessing, you know, material the Pentagon labels as vital to national security within kind of that short time frame, right? Like there's the famous Pentagon Papers case in which, you know, 20 years later, the Pentagon still hasn't declassified information. Okay. Let's start second guessing when we are 5-10 years out. But when you're talking contemporaneous classified intelligence documents, I did not make that defense for Hillary Clinton. I did not say, you know, these emails are of no consequence, right? That wasn't part of the argument. And it shouldn't be. And it shouldn't be part of the argument here for Nunes either. So I don't see that there's
anywhere to square. I'm just puzzled why I'm not seeing anybody talking about this. I don't know if you have, but all I'm seeing is people saying, oh, he really shouldn't have gone straight to the president. Like, that's pretty much all I'm seeing. How do you account for that? Are people just not, I mean,
I I think it's fatigue, right? Like Luke Russert tweeted about it. David Korn tweeted about it. But I would say it's probably the same reason that you're not seeing people banging the drum every day with respect to Ivanka Trump, with respect to
Jared Kushner. Is this as clear as Kushner?
It's as clear as Kushner.
Gosh, we need somehow I'll work that into the intro or something, because this verdict on this is clear as Kushner.
Yeah. Hashtag clear as Kushner.
Yeah. And it's so frustrating too, because this was the whole reason he did this. This is the person, by the way, who, am I right? Like, this is the leader of the committee that should be looking into, some of these charges, these allegations against the Trump administration. And the fact that he's just running up to give Trump some secret information that he heard that doesn't even vindicate what Trump has said. Like he was trying to do that to say, oh, Trump, you were right. Obama was wiretapping you. When really all this says is people in your campaign were heard because they were talking to people who were being investigated, right?
Yes. And I just want to go back to this is Nunez's own statement, right? Quote, "This is a normal incidental collection based on what I could collect. This appears to be all legally collected foreign intelligence under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act." Right. So, yeah, this is not a brave whistleblower. This is Trump loyalist discovering information and running out, holding a press conference, and then briefing the president and his political flacks on things. Like, Kellyanne Conway is not authorized to receive Foreign Intelligence Committee reports, thank God. Taking confidential information and giving it to Kellyanne Conway and giving it to Luke Russert is precisely what the Espionage Act is meant to prevent, right?
Right.
It's not 100%, right? Like the core of what it's intended to prevent is, you know, taking it and giving it to the Russians.
Yeah.
But giving it to a press who then has the right to circulate it is awfully close to giving it to the Russians, right?
So, yeah, yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, clear as Kushner,
clear
everybody.
Clear as Kushner.
All right. Let's get to our main segment for today. Okay. I'm just going to give a vague intro because I don't know anything about this, but that's fine. I think that'll be fine.
Okay.
Okay, Andrew, for our main segment, we're going to talk about jury secrecy. Now, it looks like you've labeled the case here. It's Peña Rodriguez versus Colorado. I don't know. Did this establish jury secrecy or I don't know, but I'm excited to learn about it, especially with all of the facts I learned from Lot Awful Movies number 3, which was Runaway Jury. So, I mean, I feel like I already have a very good base I'm working from here of just, you know, knowledge, factual legal knowledge from that movie. But I'm looking forward to building on that.
Yeah, this is, I think this is going to be a very, very significant case going forward. I hesitate to call it a landmark case, but it's, I think, really significant.
It's a new case.
It's a brand new case.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought we were going to be talking about like the history of it. My fault.
Nope. First time the Supreme Court has tackled this particular question that I'm about to put forward. It also helps illustrate it is another case that breaks down along non-originalist versus originalist lines, which we're not, you know, like I'm going to continue beating that drum until Gorsuch is filibustered.
Well, I have to ask right now, will this be decided or was it decided will it be decided before he's in, if he gets in?
Yeah, no, this was decided March 6th, 2017.
Okay. Yeah. Just came out. Okay, I see.
That's
good then.
It's a 5-3 decision. And so it lines up the non-originalist judges, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Justice Anthony Kennedy, who wrote the majority opinion.
So the real justices.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, on one hand, you have actual justices. Right. Got it.
And then the dissent is Thomas, Alito, and Roberts. And so, you know, Thomas and Alito are sort of hardcore originalists. You find them in every, and Roberts is, you know, 90 odd percent of the time. You know, he's thrown a couple of bones that make him a little bit unpredictable, but that this is sort of the lineup. And, you know, I was ready to predict, and I think I had sort of predicted when I thought the ninth seat was going to go to a Hillary Clinton appointee, that we were going to see, Anthony Kennedy kind of shift, left.
Yeah, you did align, say that.
And align himself with sort of the new, you know, liberal majority on the court. It seems as though he's aligned himself with the non-originalists on the court in a number of cases, including this one. So, you know, look, it remains to be seen how that's going to play out in some other cases. But this case comes out very squarely on how do you interpret the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of a right to a fair trial versus do you use the kind of originalist mentality to sort of read that guarantee into as sort of as minimal as possible. So,
okay.
So here's what we're dealing with as a factual background. By and large, we have a rule that is called the non-impeachment rule with respect to jury deliberations. And what that means is what happens in the jury room stays in the jury room, right? You cannot come out of that and complain to, if you're a juror, you can't come out of that and tell the judge, oh, hey, look, like, you know, this was crazy and you should disregard this jury's verdict because we didn't look at the facts at all, right? You know, you could imagine lots of scenarios.
It's just assumed that whatever they did in there,
yeah,
they somehow came to a good decision or something like that.
Okay. And the federal rules of evidence have a set of exceptions for when you can come out. This is actually a Colorado state case. So this is an example of when the Supreme Court can review the decisions of a state court because they impinge upon a constitutionally protected right. Right. So in other words, they're not interpreting the Colorado statute. They're asking, assuming that your interpretation of the Colorado statute is correct, does that violate the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution? And here the Supreme Court said yes. So what does the Colorado statute say? It says, inquiry into validity of verdict or indictment. Upon an inquiry into the validity or verdict of an indictment, a juror may not testify as to any matter or statement occurring during the course of the jury's deliberation or to the effect of anything upon his or any other juror's mind or emotions as influencing him to assent to or dissent from the verdict or indictment or concerning his mental processes in connection therewith. But a juror may testify about 1, whether extraneous prejudicial information was improperly brought to the juror's attention, 2, whether any outside influence was improperly brought to bear upon any juror, say somebody trying to buy off the jury from operating on a shady consulting firm, right? Or 3, whether there was a mistake in entering the verdict onto the verdict form, a la Lionel Hutz, this verdict is written on a cocktail napkin, and it still says guilty, and guilty is spelled wrong. A juror's affidavit or evidence of any statement by the juror may not be received on a matter about which the juror would be precluded from testifying. Okay, so that's the no impeachment rule. It says what happens in the jury stays in the jury.
Oh, that's the original. I thought you were reading the Colorado.
Yeah, that's the Colorado statute, which reflects the mainstream view in most states and in the federal rules of evidence, right? So what happened in this case? This was an individual, Miguel Angel Peña Rodriguez, accused of sexually assaulting 2 teenage girls in the bathroom of a horse racing facility at a racetrack. Okay. Hmm. So girls told their father, identified the man as an employee of the racetrack. And then the jurors were asked about their bias, et cetera, et cetera. After the verdict came down, 2 jurors submitted affidavits to the judge that said, we're really concerned about this jury's verdict because there was a juror identified only by his initials, HC, who said
Clinton.
Yeah. No. Right. Who said, I'm an ex-law enforcement officer, and I can tell you that Mexican men have a bravado that caused them to believe that they can do whatever they want with women. Right. The juror said that HC physically stated his belief that Mexican men are physically controlling of women because of their sense of entitlement. And he said, this is, I think, the key quote, HC saying, I think he did it because he's Mexican and Mexican men take whatever they want. Okay. According to the jurors, HC further explained that in his experience, quote, 9 times out of 10, Mexican men were guilty of being aggressive towards women and young girls. And again, wow. As a Torres, I have a very strong interest in how this case comes out. I can tell you that's a horrible slander against my people. So the facts are, in the jury deliberation room, you cannot get a more clear illustration of racial bias than that, right? Like, yeah. I think Mexicans just take what they want, and 90% of the time Mexicans are guilty, so come on, vote this guy guilty, right?
Yeah.
So the question is, can those jurors go to the judge and say, hey, look, we got a real problem here. Like, you got a jury who is coming up with a decision because they're being swayed by this racist, right?
Right.
I read the Colorado statute first because you might be able to make an argument of, you know, is that prejudicial? No. Okay. It does not, I want you to just take as a given, that it does not fall into the exceptions of the no impeachment rule, right? Because there was no specific evidence that was adduced in, right? Like, to fall within those exceptions, you have to bring in, and what happens in those cases, right? Like, so for example, we often talk about this on Law and Awful Movies. This is a good segue. You'll make an objection in court, right? In a real trial, the one attorney will ask a question. There will be an objection. The judge will say sustained, and then will turn to the jury and say, the jury will disregard that remark. Or well, there's a piece of evidence, right? The jury will disregard this piece of evidence. You are not to take it into account in your deliberation. And then if you go back into the room and the jurors say, hey, look, like, I know we were told to disregard, but like, you asked him, you know, didn't you agree? You know, didn't you sign a confession?
That would fall under.
That would fall under exceptions. One of the exceptions, right? So if the jury has been instructed to disregard a piece of evidence and the jurors deliberate about it anyway, you need to pierce through that impeachment, that no impeachment rule.
So essentially there's a very high, sounds like a high threshold or high burden for things that it's okay to go outside of the jury deliberation room later and say, hey, here's what happened and I don't think it was right. It seems like there's very few exceptions where you can actually do that.
Exactly. Okay. Right. And so this doesn't, by the terms of the statute, this doesn't apply. And in fact, that's what the lower court said. Like, hey, look, like, we agree it's really, really bad. Sounds horrible, but we're not going to invade the jury because it's near. Well,
that hopefully this would have been weeded out in jury selection or something. Right.
That's why they go into, I didn't go in, but there were questions asked during voir dire of, you know, are you racially biased? Do you have anything that would, but again, like, you know, as the lawyer, as somebody who's done this sort of thing, like, you know, when I ask somebody, are you racially biased? You would ask, you know, is there anything that would cause you to weigh the testimony of a member of one race lower than the member of any other race? Well, one of the things racists are really good at is lying, right? Like, they say, like, oh,
that's
no,
why
absolutely
you have to
not.
Ask them, does your mom know you're racist?
Yeah.
That's how, just little lawyer trick. Take voir dire tips from a podcast.
Anyway. Yeah, not this path of the podcast. So now let's go to kind of the central argument that was made and is now law, thanks to the 5-justice majority. This is part 3 of the opinion, in which they've said the 6th Amendment's protection of a fair trial, as incorporated to the states through the 14th Amendment, we've talked about that process, means that those laws, those non-incorporation laws, are void insofar as they shield from disclosure obvious racial animus that takes place in a jury. Okay.
Interesting.
And here's why. So I'm going to read a little bit. There's a little bit lengthy from the opinion, but I think it's really significant. It must become the heritage of our nation to rise above racial classifications that are so inconsistent with our commitment to the equal dignity of all persons. This imperative to purge racial prejudice from the administration of justice was given new force and direction by the ratification of the Civil War Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, right? Quote, the central purpose of the 14th Amendment was to eliminate racial discrimination emanating from official sources in the states, end of quote. in the years, and then there's a citation to the case. In the years before and after the ratification of the 14th Amendment, it became clear that racial discrimination in the jury system posed a particular threat both to the promise of the amendment and to the integrity of the civil trial. Almost immediately after the Civil War, the South began a practice that would continue for many decades. All white juries punished black defendants particularly harshly, while simultaneously refusing to punish violence by whites, including Ku Klux Klan members, against blacks and Republicans. Okay. To take one example, in the years 1865 and 1866, all white juries in Texas decided a total of 500 prosecutions of white defendants charged with killing African Americans. All 500 were acquitted. The stark and unapologetic nature of race-motivated outcomes challenged the American belief that the jury was a bulwark of liberty and prompted Congress to pass legislation to integrate the jury system and to bar persons from eligibility for jury service if they had conspired to deny the civil rights of African Americans. Members of Congress testified that legislation was necessary to preserve the right to a fair trial and to guarantee the equal protection of the laws. Okay. I could go on, but I think that piece of evidence, it shows, if you were listening to the language, right, the language adopted by the majority was the intent behind the 6th and 14th Amendments is a general anti-discrimination principle in the administration of justice. Historically, it's been a problem that juries have reached blatantly racially biased outcomes. And one of the purposes in passing the 14th Amendment was to combat that kind of racial injustice. Okay. And from that, they then concluded that the 6th Amendment right, as incorporated to the states through the 14th Amendment, outweighs history of the no impeachment rule, right? This is a big enough problem that we have to intervene and solve it. And so what that means is when you have a case like this, where the jurors come forward and say there's just outright racial prejudice in the deliberations, that renders the jury verdict null and void. You cannot reach, right? Like, this is precisely the kind of outcome that is illustrative of, you know, what is sometimes called the living model of the Constitution, right? That says you have a vague term in the Constitution, right? Which is, in this case, the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of a fair trial. Like, what's a fair trial, right? It's informed from philosophy and history as embodying a particular principle. It includes, you know, we talked about this on Tuesday's episode. It includes some evaluation of the history that was relevant at the time of the passage of the 14th Amendment, you know, which is namely bias against African Americans, and that, you know, horrifying statistic of juries in Texas just basically letting white people charged with murder go free, and then incorporates that as a sort of a general principle going forward. It may not surprise you that the dissent authored by Alito. Yes. Let's check out section one of Alito's dissent. Rules barring the admission of juror testimony to impeach a verdict, so-called no impeachment rules, have a long history. Indeed, they predate the ratification of the Constitution. They are typically traced back to this 1785 English court, in which Lord Mansfield declined to consider an affidavit from two jurors who claimed that the jury had reached its verdict by lot, right? That is, by flipping a coin. Right?
Oh, wow.
Lord Mansfield's approach soon took root in the United States, and by the beginning of the 20th century, if not earlier, the near universal and firmly established common law rule in the United States flatly prohibited the admission of juror testimony to impeach a jury verdict. I could continue to, you know, kind of read through, but essentially you have, you know, an originalist driven argument that says, hey, look, this principle of how we disregard jury testimony about what takes place in jury deliberation goes back 240 years. It was well known at the time that the 14th Amendment, it was well known at the time that the 6th Amendment was passed. It was well known at the time that the 14th Amendment was passed. If you wanted to override it, they would have said they were going to override it. They didn't. So therefore, it's, you know, now, quote, judicial activism to try and extend the 6th and 14th Amendments to apply in these particular cases. And that's right. that's how it breaks down. The dissent comes out the other way. They say, as you suggested, that the court has identified four mechanisms that protect your Sixth Amendment rights. First, jurors can be examined during voir dire. Second, during the trial, the jury is observable by the court, by counsel, and by court personnel. Third, jurors are observable by each other and may report inappropriate juror behavior to the court, italicized before they render a verdict. And fourth, after the trial, a party may seek to impeach the verdict by non-juror evidence of misconduct. These other sources of protection of petitioner's right to a competent jury convince the court that the juror testimony should be properly excluded. Right. So, there's kind of where the rubber meets the road, right? Which is to say, we look at...
Wait, did they need a unanimous decision for the
yeah, jury? And so the answer is in...
They must not yeah, have, otherwise...
In many states, you have rules that require either a 9-3 majority or, I mean, it varies state by state, but I believe that Colorado follows a 9-3 majority rule.
Because it would be interesting if it required, you know, if you would have needed every juror to go, you know, 12 jurors to go one way. But yeah, it strikes me as... interesting if one of the ways that a fair trial is going to be preserved is jurors will hold each other accountable. Well, if up to three jurors can all say like, gosh, look at this racist, but there's, you know, one racist and eight impressionable jurors, there's nothing they can do to that effect.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. So, you know, ultimately, you know, this is another illustration of one of the things that has become associated with originalism that justices like Scalia wore as a badge of honor is the "I don't care if the result is absurd," right? And you actually heard.
I was just going to bring that up. I mean, how do you feel about that? I know we've been hammering on originalism a lot lately, but I think this is a really interesting case and it's worthwhile. So, what do you think about the arguments of that you shouldn't be legislating from the bench? And if even it might be that the law leads us to a bad outcome, it's not our responsibility as justices to try to fix, like change laws. We're just here to interpret. I mean, how do you see that question as regards this particular case?
Yeah, so let me tackle the second one first, right? Which is the, we're not here to judge the outcome, right? So keep in mind, this argument is, I believe, disingenuous, right? It is always advanced by people who, by judges who have their opinions reach a conservative and non-humane outcome as a defense for why they reached that outcome, right? Like it's not like they're unaware. So for example, you talked about on Serious Inquiries Only, the Gorsuch's dissent in the trucker trapped in the ice case, right? Like, and he used the same language. He said, look, I understand it reaches this, you know, absurd result, but like my job is not to reach results. My job is to apply the law. Well, he's applying that argument only comes up when you have a particular kind of result, right? And that particular kind of result is an inhumane and horrible one, right? So the idea that that's that is some kind of abstract principle is, in my view, not true, because you see when it's invoked, right? Not invoked in other circumstances. It's always invoked when you have, you know, sort of this monstrous conservative outcome that shocks the conscience. I've talked a little bit about my history in terms of practice. That doesn't reflect what happens in real life in courts all the time, right? And I have mentioned previously, I litigated a case. I call it a case because it's a single set of operative facts, but it was actually three separate lawsuits that proceeded through every level of the Maryland state judicial system, including having cert granted twice for 8 years regarding the placement of exterior billboards on a downtown arena. Right. And I represented, I was co-counsel along with the state, along with the city of Baltimore. I represented the private parties who put up the billboards and the owner of the, of Baltimore's, indoor soccer league team, the Baltimore Blast. And opposite us was, Peter Angelos, the owner of the Baltimore Orioles, and, what I would describe as an AstroTurf group of, quote, concerned citizens that were organized to protest the exterior billboards. And in that case, the primary argument that was advanced at every level in 8 years of litigation, including before the Court of Appeals on two separate occasions, was a fairness argument, right? Was, I understand the law says X and they can do this, but it's not fair that the law says X. And in particular, what they were challenging was the act of the legislature in creating an exception to the law, because there was a citywide prohibition on exterior signage of billboards in the city. There was one exception to it for bus shelters, but what the city did was they created a new exception, and then they approved that exception with respect to the Baltimore Blast for the exterior billboards on the outside of what was then called the First Mariner Arena, which is now called the Royal Farms Arena. And they did that in one piece of legislation, right? So they created an exception and gave it to the team owner all in one fell swoop. And the argument on the other side was that looks kind of fishy and it seems unfair and they should be required to go through a more rigorous process than just the legislative process. And at every level, I had to take that argument seriously, right? Like I couldn't just go into court and say, may it please the court, the law says we can do it. They don't challenge that the law was validly enacted. Right. They don't challenge that this complies with the law. So I don't know why we're here, right? If I had done that, I firmly believe that I would have lost, right? Like I had to address questions of various aspects of zoning that were fundamentally rooted in fairness concerns.
So what you're saying is like, even if we, you know, even if we steel man and say that somebody like Gorsuch did not really want to rule against this trucker, because what the company did to him was morally wrong. Let's say he's made that claim a little bit. He soft pedals it, but let's take him at his word. He thinks that's a bad outcome, but he has no choice. The law says X, it must be X. You're saying that even if we take that him at his word and that all these originalists, you know, they have to do what this hurts them as much as it hurts us, but they have to, they have to rule this way. You're saying even just that part is not true, that there's you have this history in this case history where the judge was going to potentially evaluate fairness. Like, is this law fair? And it's not simply a question of, well, it's written this way. It is this way.
Yeah. And I would invite, we have a lot of lawyers that listen to the show, and I would invite any of them, wherever you fall on the political spectrum, to write in if your experience is different than mine. I don't believe we will get a dissent on that. I think anybody who's practiced law, who's been in court, knows that judges left, right, and center will ask themselves the question, is this fair?
When they do that, are they appealing to just another level? Like, okay, so hypothetically with Supreme Court justices, they don't always just say the law says X. They need to say, does the law violate the Constitution, essentially? Like, is this consistent,
right,
or something like that? So, or is fairness somewhere enshrined in the Constitution? So really you could just say that's what they're doing. They're not necessarily choosing for themselves whether the law is fair.
Yeah, it's not typically made that way particularly in state or in federal trial courts. It's typically made in the context of plaintiff encourages us to reach an absurd result in the law, right?
Sure.
Plaintiff's view of the law says, that X, Y, Z can happen, and that can't possibly be what the legislature meant.
Exactly what Al Franken, my new hero, Al Franken's argument was to Gorsuch, if anyone watched that. It was great. He was like, hey, there's an exception for the literal interpretation of a law. It's when it's an absurd result. This result was absurd. He just said it like three times.
And that's true, right? Like and again, you're not appealing to a specific provision of the Constitution.
Right.
This is sort of the hot dog defense, right? This is if you sign up and you get a permit to sell hot dogs on the street, and the state compliance officer comes by and you have, you know, literal flaming poodles in your cart, like, that there's no way that, you know, the court is going to uphold your right to set dogs on fire in the middle of the street, right? They're going to be like that.
It also could be the Air Bud rule. That's my favorite thing. There's no rule. It says a dog can't play basketball.
So that statement is contrary, I think, to the experience of anybody who has litigated in any case.
I wouldn't have necessarily known that. As much as I've always, you know, as much as I've listened to you and I agree with your take on originalism, I guess I wasn't sure if that was a valid argument or not. But I'm glad to have learned that now, because it makes sense when you say it. You know, judges are concerned with fairness and potentially absurd results, and we know that Scalia wasn't. We know that he was very happy with absurd results.
Yeah, well, and again, because you have a group of people who want the court to read for those individuals, right? The results aren't absurd, right? They are callous. But that's the result. The court, right? By definition, nobody thinks, right? It's the same. It's the, you know, to go back to comic book movies, right? Like, nobody thinks they're the villains in their own story, right? Like, nobody believes that they're the bad guy. They just believe that, you know, their outcome is, you know, appropriate under the set of rules that are put into place. And so, in my view, that defense is the way of kind of taking that out of ordinary scrutiny. I also want to go back kind of very quickly to your question about legislating from the bench, because I think the answer to that is yes, I strongly believe in the separation of powers. And I've made the case, it's not worth going over again here, you can listen to OA 49, that originalism actually erodes those powers and aggregates greater power to the judiciary than it ought to have by removing constraints upon the results that you can reach. I think Gorsuch is a particularly egregious example of this, as we've talked about, because he said in print while serving on the 10th Circuit, I would like to overturn the Supreme Court's rules that allow for Chevron deference in administrative cases, right? Like, you know, when you have a 10th Circuit justice who wishes he could be on the Supreme Court to overturn, you know, relative, that's a 1982 case. So, you know, I don't want to say recent, but relatively recent Supreme Court precedent, right? Like, that tells you, right? Like, he's telling you in print, I'm licking my chops, hoping someday I get to be on the Supreme Court because I can get rid of these cases. In my view, the charge of activism falls far more on the Gorsuch side. Look, there is a real core of the argument there, which is to say, I can come up with decisions from the Warren Court in the late 60s and early 70s that look like legislation from the bench. So, for example, crafting new rules that specify to school districts exactly how they must bus children into, you know, across district lines to put African-American kids in predominantly white schools and vice versa, and imposing a set of taxes to pay for that. Yeah, that looks an awful lot like legislation, right? Mm. And so you can, throughout history, pick a couple of those cases, and we could have a discussion about it, and you could make a strong argument that the school busing cases, for example, constituted legislating from the bench. I would say that phrase, outside of that context, I cannot come up with a case in the past 30 years that is comparable to those busing cases. And I would say that the phrase has, you know, not only lost its meaning, but has been deliberately employed to sort of obfuscate the shell game that is going on where right. You have, you know, we've talked at length about DC versus Heller, but, you know, you essentially had Scalia marshaling a conservative majority and saying, I'm going to take my pet view of the Second Amendment that has never been endorsed by any court in history. And I'm going to pretend as though that is the patently obvious view. I mean, you know, to me, that's just, you know, well,
yeah, again. I feel like we've hammered on originalists a lot this on that, week. So. This is a really interesting case though. And I like it. So yeah, that's Peña Rodriguez v. Colorado. Interesting. Thanks for taking us through that. Let's get on to the rest of the show.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
Now it's time for our listener question. This is longtime friend of the show, Eric Brewer. We love Eric. He's always commenting and messaging and all that. Love that participation in the show. So Eric asks, I'm curious to know why some or most places don't allow convicted felons to vote. If they've served their time and are released back into the population, then they shouldn't have a right to vote. Then shouldn't they have a right to vote? I don't know if it makes any legal sense, but the whole taxation without representation argument seems to be reasonable here, right? These are citizens who have paid their debt and who are being taxed but can't vote. Why is that legal? I would like to add that I won't remember the episode, but months and months ago, if not maybe a year ago, I did a thing on this on Comedy Shoeshine because my joke about it was like, what are we worried about? There's still like Trump versus Hillary. The worst thing that can happen is they vote for Trump. It's not like there's a felon candidate that all the felons are going to vote for. If there's like an evil candidate that they'll elect, like evil felon candidate, if we let them vote, I don't get this either. I've never gotten it. There's not like it doesn't get worse than Republicans. Like, so whatever.
I think that's I think Dan, the conservative man, just dropped his patronage.
Yeah.
There was also an episode of G.I. Joe way back in the day that was based on sneakily getting in, like Cobra was trying to get Cobra operatives elected to local government.
Yeah, we treat it like it's some, yeah, exactly, like some comic book thing where they're going to vote in, you know. I don't know, what are the guy with the spider legs and Spider-Man? That's the last one I saw. I haven't seen any of these comic book movies.
We know how you feel about comic
book movies. Yeah, exactly.
So here's the answer to the question. First, the taxation without representation has exactly as much legal force as the Declaration of Independence, right? Which is to say it's a slogan from our history, but not binding legal precedent. And as proof, I offer the citizens of the District of Columbia, right? Like they have a shadow representative in the House, Eleanor Holmes Norton. They have no representation in the Senate. They pay taxes. And in many cases, they pay, you know,
they ought to have themselves a very high rate of taxes. A Boston, yeah. A DC Tea Party.
it is part of the DC Statehood Party has tried to use the maxim of taxation without representation for as long as I can remember, you know, to sort of no effect.
Well, it makes some sense, but
of course it makes plenty of sense, but it's not a prohibition. I will say this, the law seems to be moving in a direction. We had a time period, particularly in the 1980s, in which that was marked by a great many trends in the law, but one of the trends was increasing federalization of formerly state crimes, right? Like making those federal offenses as well as state offenses, and imposing lengthy mandatory minimums for the commission of crime. So it was a sort of a Nixon-Reagan tough on crime, like that was the definition of the Republican Party back then. And, you know, you see some of that rhetoric from Donald Trump now. You didn't see that same kind of rhetoric from George H.W. Bush or even George W. Bush in the interregnum. And part of that is a cultural shift. But we're seeing a little bit of a backlash to the practical consequences of federalizing tons of state crime and imposing mandatory minimum sentences is all of a sudden you have tremendous expenses and overcrowded jail, overcrowded prisons. We did the terminology and even I slipped into it. So you have sort of all of those problems. Now we have probably not likely to go anywhere, just like it hasn't gone anywhere the past couple of years. But there have been bipartisan commissions that are looking to potentially recommend reducing or eliminating sentences for nonviolent drug offenders and revisiting currently incarcerated inmates who are incarcerated for nonviolent offenses. You have a political movement called Ban the Box, which has been effective in many states in prohibiting employers from asking. There's a standard checkbox that employers use that ask, have you been convicted of a crime? And so the Ban the Box movement, which I think, it, by the way, is far more crucial in terms of reintegration into society than voting. Not to downplay, I mean, we talk about the significance of voting on the show all the time, and I would encourage every member of our audience, particularly if you disagree with us, to register and go out and vote. So that's not to suggest it's not important, but getting a job, getting sort of basic sustenance, you know, if you think about you've paid your debt to society and have been released, for employers to kind of maintain that level of discrimination, I think is counterproductive. So I'm pro the Ban the Box campaign. And states are making progress in terms of restoring felon voting rights. So 38 states right now and the District of Columbia provide for felons to regain their right to vote. In many of those cases, it's automatic. In some cases, they have to wait for a certain period of time. And in some cases, you have to actually fill out an application. But in lots of those states, it is actually, it's automatically restored to you. So
yeah.
not quite true that that most places don't allow convicted felons to vote. Now the majority allow them to vote. Allowed to vote in federal elections, not allowed, you know, and it varies sort of state by state. In 12 states, they're still prohibited from voting in state elections. But the trends are moving in a direction that is more sort of pro integration back into society. And I think, you know, you and I and Eric are all sort of on the same page with respect to it makes
it's
sense.
It's going to make so little difference in the grand scheme of things, too.
Well, like, yeah. I mean, but now let me say, I think the statistics I am giving you are obviously through 2016, right? Like a core part of Trump's rhetoric is I really won the popular vote because Hillary Clinton used illegals and fake votes to get 3 million more popular votes than me. And that makes it really, really difficult if you are a member of a humanitarian public interest organization to go out there and organize to return the right of convicted felons to vote, right? Like that
yeah.
plays directly into that accusation. And I am sure that those organizations are having a difficult time of it right now because, you know, the other side is saying, see, look, like, you know, you want to take criminal votes and pad them to your total, like, you know, real Americans voted for Trump. And you know, that's it's a tough environment in which to operate.
Well, so. I bet you in reality, I don't know if you know any of this data, but the political breakdown of felons, like, I bet it's not that far from 50-50. Do you? I mean, it could even lean Republican for all I know. I don't care. It just seems like the principle of letting them vote is a good, to me, it makes sense if you've, you know, served your time. I don't know about, this is all after they get out, right? I don't know about.
Not during.
It's like after they get out, whatever. They're back in society. Why wouldn't they be able to vote? Seems obvious to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't know of any study that breaks down sort of the political preferences of prisoners. I mean, I will say that the organizing that occurs in prison, right? Prison ministry programs and the like we know that evangelical Christians are overrepresented among the prison population, both going in and coming out. And so, you know, it is entirely possible that restoring felon rights would actually, you know, benefit the Republican Party more so than the Democratic Party. And I don't care, right? Like, if for the same reason that I oppose voter ID laws, like, I want to be a part of the political movement that says, that looks back and says with a clear conscience, I encouraged more people to vote and be involved in the political process, not less. You heard my spiel at the beginning of the segment. I mean that, right? Like, be involved in the process, even if you disagree with me.
Be involved in the process, but just stop disagreeing with Andrew. That's what I would say. So I'm gonna go slightly different route than you.
I'm with you on that too.
Yeah. All right. Well, good question, Eric. And we kind of agree with the sentiment there, although it's not exactly based on taxation without representation per se. But it's I agree with that the sentiment of your question. Absolutely. It is time to thank our top patrons. It is Top Patron Friday. And by the way, we are inching ever closer to our next goal of a bonus Q&A for patrons only every month, which I love those Q&A. We've done a couple little things like that, and people have a ton of questions. We're never getting to everybody's questions. So that's a great goal. Help us reach that goal. And then after that, we're going to have a live show. I want this live show to happen so badly. I can't even explain. It's going to be so fun. So thanks for another strong week of patronage, getting us closer to those goals. And with that said, let's thank our all-time greats, our Hall of Famers.
Yeah, so thank you to Roger Metcalf, Danny Rosari, our pal Eli Bosnick, to Dave Nichols of Positively Doubtful Podcast. Thank you to Steve Sigmund, Jim Grove, Desecrator, Patrick Fussell, Amanda Lipnack, La Bibliotecatrice, Heather Loveridge, Geeker41, Sean Pitty, Ian and Allie, Matthew Vernon, Violet Page Hall. Thanks to our buddy Heath Enright, to Jeffrey Maynor, the Wayward Willis, to Detective Matthew Maxson, always on the case, to Xena, Dave Lovely, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, to Sharon Frankel, Squick Thinger, Ian Ryan, and Matthew Hillier. Thank you all so much.
Yeah, and thank you, Aaron Grady. You are here. Aiden McCool, Brandon Smith, TV is my girlfriend, Nukes Lion or Nukeslian, I don't know, C6 Sarah, Hunter Ash, John Bodley Esquire, Kaylee Reiser, Jeff S., Sakashite Fukusumi, Philip Strongberg, Michael Schaefer, Michaela, the Electronic Frontier Foundation at EFF.org, the Inciting Incident Podcast, Marissa Alexa McCool and her fabulous, snarky, publishy stuff, the NetSec Heathen, Frederick Alstromer, Sammy Reven, Michael Rops, Conrad Michaels, and Zabby. Thank you very, very kindly, everybody.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time to find out if I can keep this improbable streak alive of one in a row. Can I make it two in a row? We'll see.
All right. Thomas, you ready?
No.
Okay,
go ahead.
Good. So here we go. A man went shopping to buy a used car. He found one on a used car lot that was offered, quote, as is. He looked at it thoroughly. The tag on the window indicated a special 30-point inspection was done on the car. The man put a $1,000 down payment down on the car. He took the car to an independent mechanic who told him that the car had been in an accident, sustained severe damage, including a cracked engine block. The mechanic believed that the dealer had to know about such extensive damage. The man tried to return the car and get his down payment back, but the dealer refused. Stuck with a lemon, the man sued the company under a common law fraud theory. The company counterclaimed for the balance of the purchase price. Will the man likely prevail in the litigation? All right. Pretty clear.
I remember lemon laws in business law, but I don't remember any details that would help me with this question. But but I do remember that existing.
Yes. Okay. Remember that the question is asking under a common law theory of fraud, right? So lemon laws are statutory laws
that states pass.
Right. So that might actually distract you from the question. So it's a
good
thing.
Don't worry.
I knew all that.
Yeah, I knew all that. I heard the common law thing. I caught it.
Yep. I knew you did. So, okay. Your answers are A, yes, the man will likely prevail in the litigation because the dealer withheld material information intentionally and knowingly misrepresenting the condition of the car. B, yes, because the dealer has a duty to give every reason why an as-is car may go bad and list those reasons on the window. C, no, because the dealer cannot be held responsible for possible damage that the used car may have developed after years of use. Or D, no, because the dealer is absolutely protected when he sells a used car in as-is condition.
Oh, man. I hope it's not D. I hope for the sake of society and for the sake of my... This is weird because I swear it's either A or D. And I thought that was what I've had the last like two questions I thought were A or D. So maybe I'm just, you know, I'm caught in a weird groove. I think that, gosh, there's some possibility that under common law, maybe it's D and we're all screwed. Like you can just say as-is. And then you're fine. But I don't know. That seems a little that seems a little too shady. I hope that's not the case. So I think I'm going to go with A and just hope that you can sell something as is. But if you know that there's something wrong, that you would have had to disclose it in some way. So I'm hoping it's A.
All right. Well, we will find out next Tuesday. If you want to play along with Thomas, as always, you can play along on Twitter when we release our announcement tweet at OpenArgs. You should be following us on Twitter. Just quote and retweet that announcement tweet along with your explanation and answer, and we will pick a winner and give a shout out to your Twitter handle, and all sorts of fabulous prizes, fame and fortune will head your way. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
And same goes for Facebook. Follow the page, like the page, and share ... Give your answer on the post for a chance to get a little shout out. I love it. It's really fun to do. Thanks to everyone who participates. And with that said, boy, I hope I'm right. We'll see. So that, let's see. I'm 9 of 16. That would be 10 of 17, closing in on, you know, something like a respectable score, maybe, kind of. If I go on an incredible run, I could get to 13 of 20 and be at 65%, which would be, that would be nice. So that's what I'm rooting for. I'll probably be, you know, like 9 of 20. But anyway, all right, that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for pledging. And thank you so much for being Andrew, all of you out there who are Andrew. And we will see you next week.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.